His fingers found the picture he had tripped over, and he threw it across the room, furious at it for hurting him. It struck the end table beside the couch, and the now useless lamp that stood there fell over. The light bulb exploded with a hollow sound, and Andy cried out again. He felt the side of his head. More blood there now. It was crawling over his cheek in little rivulets. Panting, he began to crawl, one hand out to feel the wall. When its solidity abruptly ended in blankness, he drew in both his breath and his hand, as if he expected something nasty to snake out of the blackness and grab him. A little whoosh sound sucked in past his lips. For just one second, the totality of childhood came back, and he could hear the whisper of trolls as they crowded eagerly toward him. "Just the kitchen door, for fuck's sake," he muttered raggedly. "That's all." He crawled through it. The fridge was to the right, and he began to bear that way, crawling slowly and breathing fast, his hands cold on the tile. Somewhere overhead, on the next level, something fell over with a tremendous clang. Andy jerked up on his knees. His nerve broke, and he lost himself. He began to scream, "Help! Help! Help!" over and over until he was hoarse. He had no idea how long he might have screamed there, on his hands and knees in the black kitchen. At last he stopped and tried to get hold of himself. His hands and arms were shaking helplessly. His head ached from the thump he had given it, but the flow of blood seemed to have stopped. That was a little reassuring. His throat felt hot and flayed from all his screaming, and that made him think of the ginger ale again. He began to crawl once more, and he found the refrigerator with no further incident. He opened it, ridiculously expecting the interior light to come on with its familiar frosty white glow, and fumbled around in the cool, dark box until he found a can with a ring tab on top. Andy shut the fridge door and leaned against it. He opened the can and swilled half the ginger ale at a draft. His throat blessed him for it. Then a thought came and his throat froze. "The place is on fire," his mind told him with spurious calmness. "That's why no one's come to get you out. They're evacuating. You now. You're expendable." This thought brought on an extremity of claustrophobic terror that was beyond panic. He simply cringed back against the refrigerator, his lips pulled back from his teeth in a grimace. The strength went out of his legs. For a moment he even imagined he could smell smoke, and heat seemed to rush over him. The soda can slipped from his fingers and gurgled its contents out onto the floor, wetting his pants. Andy sat in the wetness, moaning. 6. John Rainbird thought later that things could not have worked better if they had planned it. And if those fancy psychologists had been worth a tin whistle in a high wind, they would have planned it. But as it happened, it was only the lucky happenstance of the blackout's occurrence, when it did, that allowed him to finally get his chisel under one corner of the psychological steel that armored Charlie McGee. Luck, and his own inspired intuition. He let himself into Charlie's quarters at 3:30, just as the storm was beginning to break outside. He pushed a cart before him that was no different from the ones most hotel and motel maids push as they go from room to room. It contained clean sheets and pillow slips, furniture polish, a rug shampoo preparation for spot stains. There was a floor bucket and a mop. A vacuum cleaner was clipped to one end of the cart. Charlie was sitting on the floor in front of the couch, wearing a bright blue Danskin leotard and nothing else. Her long legs were crossed in a lotus-like position. She sat that way a great deal. An outsider might have thought she was stoned, but Rainbird knew better. She was still being lightly medicated, but now the dosage was little more than a placebo. All of the psychologists were in disappointed agreement that she meant what she said about never lighting fires again. The drugs had originally been meant to keep her from burning her way out, but now it seemed sure that she wasn't going to do that, or anything else. "Hi, kid," Rainbird said. He unclipped the vacuum cleaner. She glanced over at him but didn't respond. He plugged the vacuum in, and when he started it, she got up gracefully and went into the bathroom. She shut the door. Rainbird went on vacuuming the rug. He had no plan in mind. It was a case of looking for small signs and signals, picking up on them and following them. His admiration for the girl was unalloyed. Her father was turning into a fat, apathetic pudding. The psychologists had their own terms for it. Dependency shock, and loss of identity, and mental fugue, and mild reality dysfunction. But what it all came down to was he had given up and could now be canceled out of the equation. The girl hadn't done that. She had simply hidden herself. And Rainbird never felt so much like an Indian as he did when he was with Charlie McGee. He vacuumed and waited for her to come out. Maybe. He thought she was coming out of the bathroom a little more frequently now. At first she had always hidden there until he was gone. Now sometimes she came out and watched him. Perhaps she would today. Perhaps not. He would wait and watch for signs. 7. Charlie sat in the bathroom with the door shut. She would have locked it if she could. Before the orderly came to clean the place, she had been doing some simple exercises she had found in a book. The orderly came to keep it orderly. Now the toilet seat felt cold under her. The white light from the fluorescence that ringed the bathroom mirror made everything seem cold and too bright. At first there had been a live-in companion, a woman of about 45. She was supposed to be motherly, but the motherly companion had hard green eyes with small flecks in them. The flecks were like ice. These were the people who had killed her real mother. Now they wanted her to live here with the motherly companion. Charlie told them she didn't want the motherly companion. They smiled. Then Charlie stopped talking, and she didn't say another word until the motherly companion left, taking her green ice chip eyes with her. She had made a deal with that man Hochstetter. She would answer his questions, and his alone, if he would get that motherly companion out. The only companion she wanted was her father, and if she couldn't have him, she would be alone. In many ways, she felt that the last 5 months, they told her it was 5 months, it didn't feel like anything, had been a dream. There was no way to mark time. Faces came and went with no memories attached to them, disembodied as balloons, and food had no particular taste. She felt like a balloon herself sometimes. She felt as if she were floating. But in a way, her mind told her with perfect certitude, it was fair. She was a murderer. She had broken the worst of the Ten Commandments and was surely damned to hell. She thought about this at night, with the lights turned down low so that the apartment itself seemed like a dream. She saw it all. The men on the porch wearing their crowns of flame. The cars exploding, the chickens catching fire, the smell of burning that was always the smell of smoldering stuffing, the smell of her teddy bear. And she had liked it. That was it. That was the trouble. The more she had done it, the more she had liked it. The more she had done it, the more she had been able to feel the power, a living thing getting stronger and stronger. It was like a pyramid standing upside down, standing on its tip, and the more you did it, the harder it got to stop it. It hurt to stop it, and it was fun. And so she was never going to do it again. She would die in here before she did it again. Maybe she even wanted to die in here. The idea of dying in a dream wasn't scary at all. The only two faces that weren't totally dissociated were Hochstetter's and that of the orderly who came to clean her apartment every day. Charlie had asked him once why he had to come every day, since she wasn't messy. John, that was his name, had taken a scrungy old pad from his back pocket and a cheap ballpoint pen from his breast pocket. He said, "That's just my job, kid." And on the paper he wrote, "Because they're full of shit, why else?" She'd almost giggled, but had stopped herself in time by thinking of men with crowns of fire. Men who smelled like smoldering teddy bears. Giggling would have been dangerous, so she simply pretended that she hadn't seen the note or didn't understand it. The orderly's face was a mess. He wore an eye patch. She felt sorry for him, and once she had almost asked him what happened, if he'd been in a car accident or something, but that would have been even more dangerous than giggling at his note. She didn't know why, but she felt that in every fiber. His face was very horrible to look at, but he seemed pleasant enough, and his face was no worse than the face of little Chucky Eberhardt back in Harrison. Chucky's mother had been frying potatoes when Chucky was 3, and Chucky had pulled a pan of hot fat off the stove all over himself and had almost died. Afterward, the other kids sometimes called him Chucky Hamburger and Chucky Frankenstein, and Chucky would cry. It was mean. The other kids didn't seem to understand that a thing like that could happen to any kid. When you were three, you didn't have much in the smarts department. John's face was all ripped up, but that didn't scare her. It was Hochstetter's face that scared her. And his face, except for the eyes, was as ordinary as anyone else's. His eyes were even worse than the eyes of the motherly companion. He was always using them to pry at you. Hochstetter wanted her to make fires. He asked her again and again. He took her to a room, and sometimes there would be crumpled up pieces of newspaper, and sometimes there would be little glass dishes filled with oil, and sometimes there would be other things. But for all the questions and all the fake sympathy, it always came down to the same thing. Charlie, set this on fire. Hochstetter scared her. She sensed that he had all sorts of things that he could use on her to make her light fires. But she wouldn't. Except she was scared that she would. Hochstetter would use anything. He didn't play fair. And one night she had had a dream. And in this dream, she had set Hochstetter on fire. And she had awakened with her hands stuffed into her mouth to keep back a scream. One day, in order to postpone the inevitable request, she had asked when she could see her father. It had been much on her mind, but she hadn't asked, because she knew what the answer would be. But on this day, she was feeling specially tired and low-spirited, and it had just slipped out. "Charlie, I think you know the answer to that," Hochstetter had said. He pointed to the table in the little room. There was a steel tray on the table, and it was filled with heaps of curly wood shavings. "If you'll light that, I'll take you to your father right away. You can be with him in 2 minutes." Beneath his cold, watching eyes, Hochstetter's mouth spread wide in a just pals sort of grin. "Now what say?" "Give me a match," Charlie had answered, feeling the tears threaten. "I'll light it."
"You can light it just by thinking about it. You know that."
"No, I can't. And even if I could, I wouldn't. It's wrong."
Hochstetter looked at her sadly, the just pals smile fading. "Charlie, why do you hurt yourself like this? Don't you want to see your dad? He wants to see you. He told me to tell you it was all right."
And then she did cry. She cried hard and long, because she did want to see him. Not a minute of any day went by without her thoughts turning to him, without missing him, without wanting to feel his solid arms around her. Hochstetter watched her cry, and there was no sympathy in his face, no sorrow or kindness. There was, however, careful calculation. Oh, she hated him. That had been 3 weeks ago. Since then, she had stubbornly not mentioned her father, although Hochstetter had dangled him before her constantly, telling her that her father was sad, that her father said it was okay to make fires, and worst of all, that her father had told Hochstetter that he guessed Charlie didn't love him anymore. She looked at her pale face in the bathroom mirror and listened to the steady whine of John's vacuum cleaner. When he finished that, he would change her bed. Then he would dust. Then he would be gone. Suddenly she didn't want him to be gone. She wanted to listen to him talk. At first she had always gone into the bathroom and stayed in there until he was gone. And once he had turned off the vacuum cleaner and knocked on the bathroom door, calling worriedly, "Kid, you all right? You ain't sick, are you?" His voice was so kind. And kindness, simple kindness, was so hard to come by in here that she had had to struggle to keep her voice calm and cool because the tears were threatening again. "Yes, I'm okay." She waited, wondering if he would try to take it further, try to get inside her like the others did. But he had simply gone away and started his vacuum up again. In a way, she had been disappointed. Another time, he had been washing the floor, and when she came out of the bathroom, he had said, without looking up, "Watch out for that wet floor, kid. You don't want to break your arm." That was all. But again, she had been nearly surprised into tears. It was concern. So simple and direct, it was unconscious. Just lately, she had been coming out of the bathroom to watch him more and more. To watch him, and to listen to him. He would ask her questions sometimes,
but they were never threatening ones. Still, most times, she wouldn't answer, just on general principles. It didn't stop John. He would talk to her anyway. He would talk about his bowling scores, about his dog, about how his TV got broken and it would be a couple of weeks before he could get it fixed because they wanted so much for those little tiny tubes. She supposed he was lonely. With a face like his, he probably didn't have a wife or anything. She liked to listen to him because it was like a secret tunnel to the outside. His voice was low, musical, sometimes wandering. It was never sharp and interrogative, like Hochstetter's. He required no reply, seemingly. She got off the toilet seat and went to the door, and that was when the lights went out. She stood there, puzzled, one hand on the doorknob, her head cocked to one side. It immediately came to her that this was some sort of trick. She could hear the dying whine of John's vacuum cleaner, and then he said, "Well, what the Christ?" Then the lights came back on. Still, Charlie didn't come out. The vacuum cleaner cycled back up again. Footsteps approached the door, and John said, "Did the lights go out in there for a second?"
"Yes."
"It's the storm, I guess."
"What storm?"
"Looked like it was going to storm when I came to work. Big thunderheads."
"Looked like it was going to storm. Outside." She wished she could go outside and see the big thunderheads. Smell that funny way the air got before a summer storm. It got a rainy, wet smell. Everything looked gr...
The lights went out again. The vacuum died. The darkness was total. Her only connection with the world was her hand on the brushed chrome doorknob. She began to tap her tongue thoughtfully against her upper lip. "Kid?" She didn't answer. A trick? A storm, he had said. And she believed that. She believed John. It was surprising and scary to find that she believed what someone had told her, after all this time. "Kid?" It was him again, and this time he sounded frightened. Her own fear of the dark, which had only begun to creep up on her, was sublimated in his.
"John, what's the matter?"
She opened the door and groped in front of her. She didn't go out, not yet. She was afraid of tripping over the vacuum cleaner. "What happened?" Now there was a beat of panic in his voice. It scared her. "Where's the lights?"
"They went out," she said.
"You said... the storm."
"I can't stand the dark," he said.
There was terror in his voice, and a kind of grotesque apology.
"You don't understand. I can't... I got to get out."
She heard him make a sudden blundering rush across the living room, and then there was a loud and frightening crash as he fell over something, the coffee table most likely. He cried out miserably, and that frightened her even more.
"John? John, are you all right?"
"I got to get out," he screamed. "Make them let me out, kid.
What's wrong?"
There was no answer, not for a long time. Then she heard a low, choked sound, and understood that he was crying.
"Help me," he said then,
and Charlie stood in the bathroom doorway trying to decide. Part of her fear had already dissolved into sympathy, but part of it remained questioning, hard and bright.
"Help me, oh somebody, help me," he said in a low voice,
so low it was as if he expected no one to hear or heed. And that decided her. Slowly she began to feel her way across the room toward him, her hands held out in front of her. 8. Rainbird heard her coming, and could not forbear a grin in the dark. A hard, humorless grin that he covered with the palm of his hand in case the power should come back on at that precise instant.
"John?"
He made a voice of strained agony through his grin.
"I'm sorry, kid. I just... it's the dark. I can't stand the dark. It's like the place where they put me after I was captured."
"Who put you?"
"The Kong."
She was closer now. The grin left his face and he began to put himself into the part.
"Scared.
You're scared because the Kong put you in a hole in the ground after one of their mines blew most of your face off, and they kept you there. And now you need a friend." In a way, the part was a natural.
All he had to do was make her believe that his extreme excitement at this unexpected chance was extreme fear. And of course he was afraid, afraid of blowing it. This made the shot from the tree with the ampoule of orosin look like child's play. Her intuitions were deadly sharp. Nervous perspiration was flowing off him in rivers. "Who were the Kong?" she asked, very close now. Her hand brushed lightly past his face, and he clutched it. She gasped nervously. "Hey, don't be scared," he said. "It's just that you... that hurts. You're hurting me." It was exactly the right tone. She was scared, too. Scared of the dark and scared of him. But worried about him, too. He wanted her to feel she had been clutched by a drowning man. "I'm sorry, kid." He loosened his grip but didn't let go. "Just... can you sit beside me?" "Sure." She sat down, and he jumped at the mild thud of her body coming down on the floor. Outside, far away, someone hollered something to someone else. "Let us out!" Rainbird screamed immediately. "Let us out! Hey, let us out! People in here!" "Stop it!" Charlie said, alarmed. "We're okay. I mean, aren't we?" His mind, that overtuned machine, was clicking along at high speed, writing the script, always three or four lines ahead, enough to be safe, not enough to destroy hot spontaneity. Most of all, he wondered just how long he had, how long before the lights went back on. He cautioned himself not to expect or hope for too much. He had got his chisel under the edge of the box. Anything else would be gravy. "Yeah, I guess we are," he said. "It's just the dark, that's all. I don't even have a fucking match or... oh, hey, kid, I'm sorry. That just slipped out." "That's okay," Charlie said. "Sometimes my dad says that word. Once when he was fixing my wagon out in the garage, he hit his hand with a hammer and said it five or six times. Other ones, too." This was by far the longest speech she had ever made in Rainbird's presence. "Will they come and let us out pretty soon?" "They can't until they get the power back on," he said. Miserable on the outside, gleeful on the inside. "These doors, kid, they've all got electric locks. They're built to lock solid if the power goes off. They've got you in a cell, kid. It looks like a nice little apartment, but you might as well be in jail."
"I know,"
she said quietly. He was still holding her hand tightly, but she didn't seem to mind as much now.
"You shouldn't say it, though. I think they listen."
"They," Rainbird thought, and a hot, triumphant joy flashed through him. He was faintly aware that he had not felt such intensity of emotion in 10 years. "They. She's talking about they." He felt his chisel slip farther under the corner of the box that was Charlie McGee, and he involuntarily squeezed her hand again.
"Ow!
Sorry, kid," he said, letting off.
"I know damn well they listen. But they ain't listening now, with the power off. Oh, kid, I don't like this. I gotta get out of here."
He began to tremble.
"Who are the Kong?"
"You don't know?"
"No, you're too young, I guess."
"It was the war, kid. The war in Vietnam. The Kong were the bad guys. They wore black pajamas, in the jungle. You know about the Vietnam War, don't you?" She knew about it, vaguely.
"We were on patrol and we walked into an ambush," he said.
That much was the truth, but this was where John Rainbird and the truth parted company. There was no need to confuse her by pointing out that they had all been stoned, most of the grunts smoked up well on Cambodian Red, and their West Point lieutenant, who was only one step away from the checkpoint between the lands of sanity and madness, on the peyote buttons that he chewed whenever they were out on patrol. Rainbird had once seen this Louis shoot a pregnant woman with a semi-automatic rifle, had seen the woman's 6-month fetus ripped from her body in disintegrating pieces. That, the Louis told them later, was known as a West Point abortion. So, there they were, on their way back to base, and they had indeed walked into an ambush, only it had been laid by their own guys, even more stoned than they were, and 4 guys had been blown away. Rainbird saw no need to tell Charlie all of this, or that the claymore that had pulverized half his face had been made in a Maryland munitions plant. "There were only 6 of us that got out. We ran. We ran through the jungle, and I guess I went the wrong way. Wrong way? Right way? In that crazy war, you didn't know which way was the right way because there weren't any real lines. I got separated from the rest of my guys. I was still trying to find something familiar when I walked over a landmine. That's what happened to my face. I'm very sorry, Charlie said. When I woke up, they had me, Rainbird said, now off into the never-never land of total fiction. He'd actually come into a Saigon army hospital with an IV drip in his arm. They wouldn't give me any medical treatment, nothing like that, unless I answered their questions. Now, carefully. If he did it carefully, it would come right. He could feel it. His voice rose, bewildered and bitter. Questions, all the time, questions. They wanted to know about troop movements, supplies, light infantry deployment, everything. They never let up. They were always at me. Yes, Charlie said fervently, and his heart gladdened. I kept telling them I didn't know anything, couldn't tell them anything, that I was nothing but a lousy grunt, just a number with a pack on its back. They didn't believe me. My face, the pain. I got down on my knees and begged for morphine. They said after I told them I could have the morphine, I could be treated in a good hospital. After I told them. Now Charlie's grip was the one that was tightening. She thought about Hochstetter's cool gray eyes, of Hochstetter pointing at the steel tray filled with curly wood shavings. I think you know the answer. If you light that, I'll take you to see your father right away. You can be with him in 2 minutes. Her heart went out to this man with the badly wounded face, this grown man who was afraid of the dark. She thought she could understand what he had been through. She knew his pain. And in the dark, she began to cry silently for him. And in a way, the tears were also for herself, all the unshed tears of the last 5 months. They were tears of pain and rage for John Rainbird, her father, her mother, herself. They burned and scourged. The tears were not silent enough to go unheard by Rainbird's radar ears. He had to struggle to suppress another smile. Oh yes, the chisel was well planted. Tough cracks and easy cracks, but no impossible cracks. They just never believed me. Finally, they threw me into a hole in the ground, and it was always dark. There was a room, I guess you'd say, with roots sticking out of the earth walls. And sometimes I could see a little sunlight about 9 feet up. They'd come, their commandant, I guess he was, and he'd ask me if I was ready to talk yet. He said I was turning white down there like a fish, that my face was getting infected, that I'd get gangrene in my face, and then it would get into my brain and rot it and make me crazy, and then I'd die. He'd ask me if I'd like to get out of the dark and see the sun again, and I'd plead with him. I'd beg. I'd swear on my mother's name that I didn't know anything. And then they'd laugh and put the boards back and cover them up with dirt. It was like being buried alive. The dark. Like this. He made a choked sound in his throat, and Charlie squeezed his hand tighter to show him that she was there. There was the room, and there was a little tunnel about 7 feet long. I had to go down to the end of the tunnel to, you know. And the air was bad, and I kept thinking I'm going to smother down here in the dark. I'm going to choke on the smell of my own He groaned. I'm sorry. This is nothing to tell a kid. That's all right. If it makes you feel better, it's all right. He debated, and then decided to go just a little further. I was down there for 5 months before they exchanged me. What did you eat? They threw down rotted rice. And sometimes spiders, live spiders. Great big ones, tree spiders, I guess. I'd chase after them in the dark, you know, and kill them and eat them. Oh, gross. They turned me into an animal, he said, and was quiet for a moment, breathing loudly. You got it better than me, kid, but it comes down to pretty much the same thing, a rat in a trap. You think they'll get the lights on pretty soon? She didn't say anything for a long time, and he was coldly afraid that he had gone too far. Then Charlie said, It doesn't matter. We're together.
All right, he said. And then in a rush, you won't tell, will you? They'd fire me for the way I've been talking. I need this job. When you look the way I do, you need a good job.
No, I won't tell.
He felt the chisel slip smoothly in another notch. They had a secret between them now. He was holding her in his hands. In the dark, he thought how it would be to slip his hands around her neck. That was the final object in view, of course. Not their stupid tests, their playground games. Her. And then perhaps himself. He liked her. He really did. He might even be falling in love with her. The time would come when he would send her over, looking carefully into her eyes all the time. And then, if her eyes gave him the signal he had looked for so long, perhaps he would follow her. Yes. Perhaps they would go into the real darkness together. Outside, beyond the locked door, eddies of confusion passed back and forth, sometimes near, sometimes far away. Rainbird mentally spat on his hands and then went back to work on her. 9. Andy had no idea that they hadn't come to get him out because the power failure had automatically locked the doors. He sat in a half-swoon of panic for some unknown time, sure the place was burning down, imagining the smell of smoke. Outside, the storm had cleared and late afternoon sunshine was slanting down toward dusk. Quite suddenly, Charlie's face came into his mind, as clearly as if she had been standing there in front of him. She's in danger. Charlie's in danger. It was one of his hunches, the first he'd had since that last day in Tashmore. He thought he had lost that along with the push, but apparently that was not so, because he had never had a hunch clearer than this one, not even on the day Vicky was killed. Did that mean the push was still there, too? Not gone at all, but only hiding? Charlie's in danger. What sort of danger? He didn't know. But the thought, the fear, had brought her face clearly in front of him, outlined on this darkness in every detail. And the image of her face, her wide-set blue eyes and fine-spun blonde hair, brought guilt like a twin. Except that guilt was too mild a word for what he felt. It was something like horror that he felt. He had been in a craze of panic ever since the lights went out, and the panic had been completely for himself. It had never even occurred to him that Charlie must be in the dark, too. No, they'll come and get her out. They probably came and got her out long ago. Charlie's the one they want. Charlie's their meal ticket. That made sense, but he still felt that suffocating surety that she was in some terrible danger. His fear for her had the effect of sweeping the panic for himself away, or at least of making it more manageable. His awareness turned outward again and became more objective. The first thing he became aware of was that he was sitting in a puddle of ginger ale. His pants were wet and tacky with it, and he made a small sound of disgust. Movement. Movement was the cure for fear. He got on his knees, felt for the overturned Canada Dry can, and batted it away. It went clink-rolling across the tiled floor. He got another can out of the fridge. His mouth was still dry. He pulled the tab and dropped it down into the can, and then drank. The ring tab tried to escape into his mouth, and he spat it back absently, not pausing to reflect that only a little while ago. That alone would have been excuse enough for another 15 minutes of fear and trembling. He began to feel his way out of the kitchen, trailing his free hand along the wall. This level was entirely quiet now, and although he heard an occasional faraway call, there seemed to be nothing upset or panicky about the sound. The smell of smoke had been a hallucination. The air was a bit stale because all the convectors had stopped when the power went off, but that was all. Instead of crossing the living room, Andy turned left and crawled into his bedroom. He felt his way carefully to the bed, set his can of ginger ale on the bed table, and then undressed. 10 minutes later, he was dressed in fresh clothes and feeling much better. It occurred to him that he had done all of this with no particular trouble, whereas after the lights went out, crossing the living room had been like crossing a live minefield. Charlie, what's wrong with Charlie? But it wasn't really a feeling that something was wrong with her, just a feeling that she was in danger of something happening. If he could see her, if he could ask her what...
He laughed bitterly in the dark. Yes, right. And pigs will whistle, beggars will ride. Might as well wish for the moon in a mason jar. Might as well... For a moment his thoughts stopped entirely, and then moved on, but more slowly and with no bitterness. Might as well wish to think businessmen into having more self-confidence. Might as well wish to think fat ladies thin. Might as well wish to blind one of the goons who had kidnapped Charlie. Might as well wish for the push to come back. His hands were busy on the bedspread, pulling it, kneading it, feeling it. The mind's need, nearly unconscious, for some sort of constant sensory input. There was no sense in hoping for the push to come back. The push was gone. He could no more push his way to Charlie than he could pitch for the Reds. It was gone. Is it? Quite suddenly he wasn't sure. Part of him, some very deep part, had maybe just decided it didn't buy his conscious decision to follow the path of least resistance and give them whatever they wanted. Perhaps some deep part of him had decided not to give up. He sat feeling the bedspread, running his hands over and over it. Was that true, or only wishful thinking brought on by one sudden and unprovable hunch? The hunch itself might have been as false as the smoke he'd thought he smelled, brought on by simple anxiety. There was no way to check the hunch, and there was certainly no one here to push. He drank his ginger ale. Suppose the push had come back. That was no universal cure-all. He, of all people, knew that. He could give a lot of little pushes, or three or four wallopers before he tipped himself over. He might get to Charlie, but he didn't have a snowflake's chance in hell of getting them out of here. All he would succeed in doing was pushing himself into the grave via brain hemorrhage. And as he thought of this, his fingers went automatically to his face where the numb spots had been. Then there was the matter of the thorazine they had been feeding him. The lack of it, the lateness of the dose due when the lights had gone out, had played a large part in his panic, he knew. Even now, feeling more in control of himself, he wanted that thorazine and the tranquil, coasting feeling it brought. At the beginning, they had kept him off the thorazine for as long as 2 days before testing him. The result had been constant nervousness and a low depression like thick clouds that never seemed to let up, and back then he hadn't built up a heavy thing as he had now. "Face it, you're a junkie," he whispered. He didn't know if that was true or not. He knew that there were physical addictions like the one to nicotine and to heroin, which caused physical changes in the central nervous system. And then there were psychological addictions. He had taught with a fellow named Bill Wallace, who got very, very nervous without his three or four Cokes a day, and his old college buddy Quincy had been a potato chip freak, but he had to have an obscure New England brand, Humpty Dumpty. He claimed no other kind satisfied. And he supposed those qualified as psychological addictions. He didn't know if his craving for his pill was physical or psychological. He only knew that he needed it. He really needed it. Just sitting here and thinking about the blue pill in the white dish had him cotton-mouthed all over again. They no longer kept him without the drug for 48 hours before testing him, although whether that was because they felt he couldn't go that long without getting the screaming memes, or because they were just going through the motions of testing, he didn't know. The result was a cruelly neat, insoluble problem. He couldn't push if he was full of thorazine, and yet he simply didn't have the will to refuse it. And, of course, if they caught him refusing it, that would open a whole new can of worms for them, wouldn't it? Real night crawlers. When they brought him the blue pill in the white dish after this was over, he would take it. And little by little, he would work his way back to the calmly apathetic, steady state he had been in when the power went off. All of this was just a spooky little side trip. He would be back to watching PTL Club and Clint Eastwood on home box office soon enough, and snacking too much out of the always well-stocked fridge. Back to putting on weight. Charlie's in danger. Charlie's in all sorts of trouble. She's in a world of hurt. If so, there was nothing he could do about it.
And even if there was, even if he could somehow conquer the monkey on his back and get them out of here, pigs will whistle and beggars will ride, why the hell not? Any ultimate solution concerning Charlie's future would be as far away as ever. He lay back on his bed, spread-eagled. The small department of his mind that now dealt exclusively with Thorazine continued to clamor restlessly. There were no solutions in the present, and so he drifted into the past. He saw himself and Charlie fleeing up Third Avenue in a kind of slow-motion nightmare. A big man in a scuffed cord jacket, and a little girl in red and green. He saw Charlie, her face strained and pale, tears running down her cheeks after she had got all the change from the payphones at the airport. She got the change and set some serviceman's shoes on fire. His mind drifted back even further to the storefront in Port City, Pennsylvania, and Mrs. Gurney, sad, fat Mrs. Gurney, who had come into the wait-off office in a green pantsuit, clutching at the carefully lettered slogan that had actually been Charlie's idea. "You will lose weight, or we will buy your groceries for the next 6 months." Mrs. Gurney, who had borne her truck dispatcher husband, four children, between 1950 and 1957, and other children were grown up, and they were disgusted with her, and her husband was disgusted with her, and he was seeing another woman, and she could understand that, because Stan Gurney was still a good-looking, vital, virile man at 55. And she had slowly gained 160 pounds over the years since the second-to-last child had left for college, going from the 140 she had weighed at marriage to an even 300 pounds. She had come in, smooth and monstrous and desperate in her green pantsuit, and her ass was nearly as wide as a bank president's desk. When she looked down into her purse to find her checkbook, her three chins became six. He had put her in a class with three other fat women. There were exercises and a mild diet, both of which Andy had researched at the public library. There were mild pep talks, which he billed as counseling. And every now and then there was a medium-hard push. Mrs. Gurney had gone from 300 to 280 to 270, confessing with mixed fear and delight that she didn't seem to want second helpings anymore. The second helping just didn't seem to taste good. Before, she had always kept bowls and bowls of snacks in the refrigerator, and donuts in the bread box, and two or three Sara Lee cheesecakes in the freezer, for watching TV at night. But now she somehow, well, it sounded almost crazy, but she kept forgetting they were there. And she had always heard that when you were dieting, snacks were all you could think of. It certainly hadn't been this way, she said, when she tried Weight Watchers. The other three women in the group had responded eagerly and kind. Andy merely stood back and watched them, feeling absurdly paternal. All four of them were astounded and delighted by the commonality of their experience. The toning-up exercises, which had always seemed so boring and painful before, now seemed almost pleasant. And then there was this weird compulsion to walk. They all agreed that if they hadn't walked a good bit by the end of the day, they felt somehow ill at ease and restless. Mrs. Gurney confessed that she had got into the habit of walking downtown and back every day, even though the round trip was more than 2 miles. Before, she had always taken the bus, which was surely the sensible thing to do since the stop was right in front of her house. But the one day she had taken it, because her thigh muscles did ache that much, she'd got to feeling so uneasy and restless that she had got off at the second stop. The others agreed, and they all blessed Andy McGee for it, sore muscles and all. Mrs. Gurney had dropped to 250 at her third weigh-in, and when her six-week course ended, she was down to 225 pounds. She said her husband was stunned at what had happened, especially after her failure with countless dieting programs and fads. He wanted her to go see a doctor. He was afraid she might have cancer. He didn't believe it was possible to lose 75 pounds in 6 weeks by natural means. She showed him her fingers, which were red and calloused from taking in her clothes with needle and thread. And then she threw her arms around him, nearly breaking his back, and wept against his neck. His alumni usually came back, just as his more successful college students usually came back at least once, some to say thanks, some merely to parade their success before him, to say in effect, "Look here, the student has outraced the teacher," something that was hardly as uncommon as they seemed to think. Andy sometimes thought. But Mrs. Gurney had been one of the former. She had come back to say hello and thanks a lot only 10 days or so before Andy had begun to feel nervous and watched in Port City. And before the end of that month, they had gone on to New York City. Mrs. Gurney was still a big woman. You noticed the startling difference only if you had seen her before, like one of those before and after ads in the magazines. When she dropped in that last time, she was down to 195 pounds. But it wasn't her exact weight that mattered.